is Jerry Brown the next Thomas Jefferson? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is my co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
As always, Barry, it's great to be with you here in the studio, looking over some of the things that we want to talk about with the folks out there in WLRY land.
Okay, well, you know, one of the things that I'm sure is on everybody's minds right now, Charles, is the federal government. Why? Well, there have been a lot of things that have happened during this last week that have brought the actions or inactions or mistakes or out-and-out errors of the federal government to the forefront of pretty much every American's mind. We have had, and we're going to talk a little bit about all of these, the implementation of the Obamacare exchanges has started. This is the opening of the period that I think ends in March of next year, where you can sign up early to be and to get your Obamacare, whether it be you're signing up for the insurance that is being provided by the federal government, or if you're signing up to basically get quotes from some of the exchange participant insurance companies. Well, we've heard that decried in many instances around the blogosphere and on the media, but not the major media, because obviously they love it, as being that we've now fully gone into socialism in America. Well, we're going to talk here in a little bit. We got news for people. We've been there a lot longer than just the last week. The other thing that a lot of people are talking about is the shutdown, or slim down if you want to be liberal about it, where the Congress could not agree between the Senate and the House to pass either a budget or a continuing resolution to fund what would be considered quote-unquote vital programs. Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, when I say the word vital programs, I am not equating that with constitutionally authorized programs, because they don't do that either. But the things that they believe are vital, like paying the troops, like keeping monuments and tourist options open, like the national parks, those kind of things. Really, that's what this is all wrestling about. And, of course, people are demagoguing some certain things in there, and we'll talk about that some more. But, Chuck, the key thing, and I think this is one that surprised me a little bit, I don't know about you, but is actually very important, is the actions of a liberal California governor and how those particular actions might actually be a spearhead to regaining our liberty.
Well, I've learned long ago, having been around paying attention to politics for a long time, never to be surprised by what Governor Moonbeam does. And by Governor Moonbeam, I mean Jerry Brown, who's been governor in the past. He was governor in the 70s of California, and now he's doing his repeat term. He's actually a little weirder now than he was in the 70s, which it's really difficult to believe. Pardon me. And so occasionally, I think you put it, In a way that I would was thinking about it in, and that's the blind squirrel who finds an acorn once in a while.
Yeah, I think we said that. We were talking off air, but yes, that's and honestly, I'm okay with that.
I'm fine with it. Being right for the wrong reason still means you're right.
Still means you're right. That's
yeah. Great. It's the stop clock syndrome. Even a stop clock's right twice a day. We may have something like that. Although, you know, this is one of those places where kind of left-wing libertarianism and conservatism, constitutionalism, more accurately, intersect. And, you know, I'm always happy when anybody comes to the constitutional understanding, even if it's from a wrong worldview. And Jerry Brown's worldview is very wrong, but he's still come to the right conclusion on this. And by the way, you know, you made mention of the fact of Congress passing a budget or passing continuing resolutions. We are now, almost a year into Barack Obama's second term?
Yes.
I don't believe there has been an actual operating budget during his entire presidency.
No, there has not been.
They have been operating on continuing resolutions now for going on 5 years. That's pretty dismal. That's a really dismal record, and it speaks of a deep problem with the way people are thinking about government spending. And it's not just at the federal level. It's also at the state levels. But that's not really what we're talking about in today's show. It will come up because you can't avoid it. But the fact is that one of the reasons we're sitting in the middle of a government shutdown, and today as we record this, there's all kinds of strange things going on Capitol Hill. A conservative congressman was attacked by someone on the steps of the Capitol, and someone attempted to crash through the barriers in front of the Capitol, and there was shooting. The details are nebulous at this recording, so we really don't know what the details are. I'm sure by Saturday when this runs, we'll know more.
We'll have a little bit better.
So you'll know what's going on, because we really don't know what's going on, although somebody's apparently shot or dead or something. That's all we know.
Which honestly, Chuck, it just goes to show you why we have to be careful not to get too excited about what's going on, because you have people, Chuck, who, for some reason, well, we know what the reason is. Let's not kid ourselves. We know what the reason is. That you've got some people out there who believe that if the government, quote-unquote, shuts down, it's the end of the universe, because that is their universe, that they are so totally dependent upon government subsidy or government handout or government employment, that to think of the idea that maybe that's not necessary and maybe they need to be able to fend for themselves a little bit more is so frightening that they're willing to become desperate and do things like physically attack people or try to crash their car into the Capitol.
And vice versa. There are people out there that are so intent upon having the government to shut down that they're willing to do the same thing.
Well, exactly. And yeah, and I don't want to paint like a one-sided brush here. There are extreme views on both ends of the spectrum on this. But speaking of ends of the spectrum, I think probably one of the most extreme ends of the spectrum has been the historical policies and views of California's current governor, former governor, and now current governor again, Jerry Brown. I mean, if you want to talk about a liberal's liberal, Jerry Brown would probably be one of the poster children that a lot of people could come up with as being a liberal's liberal.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, in the People's Republic of California, he's the chairman. And so you probably would think it's kind of funny, odd, strange, or that you and I have just kind of like lost track of reality and we've been hallucinating, to say that we're applauding California Governor Jerry Brown this week. I got to give him the Attaboy Award for this, because, again, like we said, even a blind squirrel can find an acorn sometimes. What has Jerry Brown done? Well, Chuck, you want to throw into?
No, go ahead.
Okay, all right. What has Jerry Brown done? Well, Jerry Brown did what Jerry Brown usually does. He signed more bills into law in California. Now I can hear our audience now, wait a minute, I thought you were the guys for limited government. Why are you applauding somebody adding more regulations to the California code? Well, it's what he's adding to the code, Chuck. He signed Assembly Bill 351 into law on Tuesday. On the 1st of October, the governor was presented with Assembly Bill 351, and he signed it into law. What is Assembly Bill 351, you might ask? It is called the California Liberty Preservation Act. And it's a piece of legislation, Charles, that would specifically say that any agency of the state of California, political subdivision of the state, employee of a state or local agency, or members of the California National Guard, their participation in basically detaining the citizens of California with indefinitely without charges is illegal in the state of California. Well, it's interesting, Chuck, because what he's done, Jerry Brown, liberals liberal, has championed nullification. This bill is a nullification of the Federal Patriot Act, or at least portions, or the NDAA, excuse me, not the Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act, which we've talked about on this program in the past.
Right.
And if folks go to our archive at principledpolicy.com, they can listen to the shows we talked about the NDAA and how bad it is. Well, basically, he's saying no state agent in California or local agent in California is going to be able to aid any of the armed forces of the U.S. in trying to investigate, prosecute, or detain a person within California under the NDAA. So what they've said is, not in my state, you're not.
Yes.
It's incredible. This is honest to goodness, no holds barred, state strength nullification. They are basically saying, we're not going to allow it to operate in our state. I don't care if it's a federal law. Bravo, Jerry Brown.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Well, let's talk about what that law means. What has been called in the past and what it really means. It has in the past been called nullification.
That's right.
It's also called, in one document, I believe in the Virginia Resolves of 1798, it's called interposition.
Right. And those two are very similar doctrines. Interposition, and we've talked about this on the program before, interposition is where a lower level of agent or actor interposes between a powerless actor or a much less powered actor and a very powerful one to protect them from being tyrannized. Now, in this instance, it's the state of California stepping in to protect the citizens of California from a federal law that, well, Chuck, as we've talked about it before, has no real grounding in constitutional warrant. It's an unconstitutional law.
I think what's important about the language of this law, there's a couple of things in here that I find problematic. And one of them is, knowingly using state funds and funds allocated by the state to those local entities on or after January 1st, 2013.
Well, yes.
Okay. What's the problem there that you can see?
Well, of course, it's October 2013, so if they've done any of that put in those time frames, it's an ex post facto law.
Exactly, which is strictly forbidden.
But, however, what really is the case, and usually this happens with state-level legislation,
right. They
set a date. I mean, last year this bill could have been introduced in the hopper, and they set a date. What they do is then when they go into rulemaking, they just adjust the date. But for purposes of when the statute was validated, it's based upon when the governor signed it into law. So it could say January 1st of 2013, but it still doesn't have the force of law until that state constitutional provision has been taken care of with the engrossing and enrolling of that into the statutes.
Now, here's the other problem I see, and it has to do with the status of the National Guard. A lot of people believe that the National Guard are state troops.
They do, but the word national ought to give them a little bit of a clue.
According to the Dick Act, which was passed, I think, in 1909,
You're better at those history notes than I am.
The National Guard are actually federal troops.
Yes.
They are placed under the command of state governors, but they can be called up at a moment's notice by the word of the President of the United States. And if it was a state militia like we used to have before the Dick Act, also called the National Guard Act, what would happen was that Congress would have to authorize the president to call up the National Guard. There were, in recent times, and I'm not going to make any editorial comment about this, but the fact is that the National Guard has been called up at different times to deal with different issues by the President of the United States on domestic issues. One of them, Little Rock, in the 1950s, Montgomery, Alabama, in the 1960s, where the governors basically did assume that the president wasn't going to use that power, and the president did use that power. Eisenhower called him up in the 50s, and Kennedy called him up in the 60s to deal with issues of enforcing federal court orders.
That's right.
Wherein state governors essentially attempted to nullify federal court orders. So this is one of those problems with going over from the constitutional system, which is a militia. And this thing about court-forced segregation of schools, man, if we go off in there, we're just basically going to get lost in the weeds. let's face it. It's an emotional issue, and people don't want to talk about it, but you have to think about these terms in terms of constitutional fidelity.
That's true.
And that had nothing to do with constitutional fidelity. It's basically the federal government seizing power it didn't have and using a law passed that's probably unconstitutional in the Dick Act to nationalize state troops. Should be state troops.
Right.
They wouldn't be able to do that if those were militia members.
No, that's true. They would not. But what we have, Chuck, is I think that the language in this bill actually almost sews that up a little bit, because it says that it prevents a member of the California National Guard from aiding an agency of the armed forces, which it would be their agency. And the National Guard's federalized. They would be prohibited as Californians from taking part in it. So one would see that there could be a potential, which I doubt is very high, of people resigning their commissions in the California National Guard in order to support this law. Now, you think that's far-fetched. I'm not really sure that it is, because when it gets right down to it, this bill, this provision, this is a touchstone piece of policy, Chuck. It has people on both sides of the political spectrum aligning together. I mean, this isn't a left-right thing anymore. I mean, when you got a liberal governor like Jerry Brown signing this bill, this is pretty incredible. But then you look at the history of the bill. It was introduced in the California Assembly in their House by a Tim Donnelly, who's a conservative Republican who's now running for governor of California, which is also makes it interesting, because I don't know if Jerry Brown's termed out at this point or not, but if he's not, then he just signed a bill into law from the person who's going to be running against him for governor. So maybe there were some political aspects to this, so trying to nullify it and catching the wave himself. But in the Senate, the California Senate, which I'm not sure there are really that many conservative members of the California Senate, but the key sponsor in the Senate was the, quote, most liberal lawmaker of the Senate, Senator Mark Leno. Now, that's some strange bedfellows, Chuck.
Again, it's that clash of left libertarianism and right libertarianism and where those interests intersect.
Now, it's interesting, because this is a quote in an article that we're reading from the New American called Governor Signs California Indefinite Detention Nullification Bill, written by Joe Wolverton, and it says, quote, indefinite detention, by its very definition, means that we're abrogating, suspending, just throwing away the basic foundations of our Constitution and our nation, Senator Leno said. Not the conservative Republican,
yeah.
The liberal leftist said this, okay? Sometimes everybody just gets it, Chuck.
Yes.
There comes that moment of absolute clarity when everybody gets it. They know what's happening. As a matter of fact, Leno continues on. He said, it doesn't matter where one finds oneself on the political spectrum. These two sections of this National Defense Act are wrong, unconstitutional, and never should have been included. Wow. I mean, folks, this is why we constantly caution our listening audience, don't fall into the trap of thinking Republican equals good, Democrat equals bad,
right.
Because on an issue-by-issue basis, it's character that matters, not party affiliation. It is whether or not you are grounded in biblical and constitutional principles, regardless of whether or not you're a card-carrying member of the GOP or the Dems. That's where the rubber meets the road, because sometimes you get issues like this one that transcend party politics in many ways. Now, if you don't believe me yet, let me give you a listing of the proponents, the supporters of Assembly Bill 351. And I list some of them. Taxpayers for Improving Public Safety. That could go either way. The Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Well, that could go either way. It could be a liberal or conservative. The 10th Amendment Center. Well, that's a right libertarian organization.
Yes, it's strongly libertarian, yeah.
The California American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU. Okay, now we are not
Not a bastion. Not a bastion of conservative thought.
We're not going to mischaracterize them as being conservative in any way, shape, or form. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors, President David Chu.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, well.
The Libertarian Party of California. And the Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors. So, in other words, there are local government officials saying, please, please pass this bill. We do not want to see California citizens harassed, hounded, rounded up, and detained with indefinitely.
Oh, absolutely not. Now, I will tell you one of the motivating factors. Now, of course, this is all about the NDAA and indefinite detention. But in the background, kind of quietly underneath, California is very libertarian, shall we say, regarding drug policy.
Yes, I would say that's kind. Yeah.
And this is a stepping stone to basically also nullifying federal drug laws.
Could very well be.
And I frankly, you know, people, I'm a little taken aback by some of the stuff I see, you know, people just going nuts about marijuana laws and how we need to keep. I'm like, okay, I don't want to die on that hill. I am not an imbiber. But is that something that I think is so important that we maintain that we continue to do the drug war, which has been used as an excuse to create the civil libertarian nightmare and the apparatus that we currently have? You know, people being sent away for having a pound of marijuana. Well, it's for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's completely disproportionate. That should be a local decision, a state and local decision, not a federal decision. You know, the federal government can outlaw the interstate commerce, but we've seen what's happened with this idea of regulation of interstate commerce, and that's part of what's behind this. But I don't want to make too fine a point on that because the language of this bill is specifically about indefinite detention, because these guys can see what's going to happen. This isn't just about terrorism, if you will. And remember, terrorism is one of those catch-all phrases. What they can see is that indefinite detention being used for all kinds of different things. Things suddenly being labeled terrorists or potential terrorist when it has nothing to do with attacking government entities like post office and government offices and that kind of thing. It could be translated into all kinds of different things, and they see that. That's where that left libertarian thing coincides with the right libertarian thing. Even though they may not see the same things as a threat, they both see the threat.
Mm-hmm. They do. Now, on the downside, AB 351 could have been a lot stronger.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that did happen, sadly enough, was by the time the bill got to the governor's desk, penalty provisions for participating illegally against the laws of California in those type of interrogations and rounding up of citizens were dropped. So there's no penalty provision. However, I do believe that maybe what they were trying to do was to create a moral framework for moving forward with this particular idea, as you mentioned, maybe in other areas. But the key is, it's really one of the key first steps. When you've got a state that is historically and notoriously as liberal as the state of California, passing nullification bills... You know, we're not talking about Wyoming anymore. We're not talking about the Deep South anymore, you know, and some of the states that... Texas. We're not talking about the Republic of Texas anymore. We're talking about California. I mean, this is significant in and of itself, regardless of how the strength or the relative strength or weakness of the bill. It's the point that the effort was made and was passed with a interesting, diverse, some would say politically ecumenical coalition.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
You know, to kind of put it in our frame. So, but that's where I think we have to say we applaud what's going on, because it's helping to be a stepping stone or a lamp, if you might, to how states can get their liberty back. Because, again, this is fully cognizant and fully in tune with the provisions that our founders left us, not just in the Constitution, but then later with the Anti-Federalist legacy of the 10th Amendment.
Yeah. Actually, the entire Bill of Rights.
You know, because, the entire Bill of Rights, yes.
The nationalists, the so-called Federalists who were the nationalists at the convention, didn't want them. James Madison. Now, this is one of the things I've had trouble with some of these so-called, quote-unquote, experts who are pushing for a constitutional convention. You have been reading my copy of Mark Levin's books, and one of the mistakes he makes in there is talking about how James Madison wrote the Bill of Rights. James Madison did not write the Bill of Rights.
No, he did not.
James Madison was the editor of the Bill of Rights.
Yes, he was, and he was the man who carried the Bill of Rights on the floor of Congress.
That's right.
Because the real author of the Bill of Rights probably wouldn't have gotten a hearing, because he was also one of the people who didn't sign the Constitution.
That's right.
And that is my favorite founder of all time, even more so than Sam Adams, George Mason.
George Mason. George Mason wrote several. He definitely wrote, if I'm not mistaken, he wrote the First Amendment.
Yes.
There were hundreds of proposals for amendments, and what Madison did was took those proposals and edited them down to combine a whole lot of them. Some of the hundreds were on the same issues. But the bottom line here is that Madison got his hand forced. He was absolutely against a Bill of Rights, and a lot of the Federalists were against a Bill of Rights, and they weren't going to get the Constitution ratified without a promise of the Bill of Rights. So he suddenly became cognizant of the need. All of a sudden, James Madison became a very enthusiastic supporter when it became obvious that the Constitution was not going to be ratified without a promise of the Bill of Rights, and thank the Lord that the Anti-Federalists were there stirring the pot. Now, the fact is that the Bill of Rights is currently being ignored, which is what AB 351 is all about. They see the fact that the Fourth Amendment is being ignored, the Fifth Amendment is being ignored, the First Amendment is being ignored. California isn't so hot on the Second Amendment.
No, they haven't historically, but this could also lead, and think about it inadvertently, to their strengthening some of their assembly members to go back and try to strengthen their Second Amendment protections.
Yeah, because the question becomes obvious after a while. And by the way, I mentioned the First, Fourth, and Fifth. Now there are problems, and I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime, Barry, but there are problems with the Third Amendment. And the Third Amendment basically, well, just for fun, I'll read it and you'll say, what? What's that have to do with anything? Well, you'll see what it has to do. It has more to do with the spirit of the law than the letter of the law.
Okay.
But here it is. No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Now, one of the corollaries of that thing is that basically your home is your private possession, and you are the sovereign over that particular domain, and you don't have to allow it to be used for anything within the limits of the law. Well, what have we got a case of now in one state? We've got a case, I believe it's in Utah, of all strange places, where the county sheriff decided that he wanted to do surveillance on a place for suspected drug activity, and he went to the next door neighbor of this place and asked if he could use their home for surveillance of this place, and they said no. We don't want to be involved in that. We want nothing to do with it. You know, we want to, if they are drug dealers, we don't want to have, you know, have it come out that, and frankly, we just want nothing to do with it. So what happened to those people? They were arrested for obstructing an investigation.
Well, of course, of course.
So there is a Third Amendment lawsuit currently in the federal court. Now, how does that lend itself here? Well, while the sheriff's office is not exactly soldiers, and the fact is that the spirit of the law is that the government shall not require you to allow your property to be used by them in that kind of an activity. So we see those kinds of things coming up. People reinterpreting the Constitution to meet their will and whim. And
we've been blamed of that sometimes for people who haven't read the documents.
Well, that's exactly right. Now, we also see Article 6 of the Bill of Rights being violated by the NDAA. Article 7. Article 8.
Yes.
Let's talk about Article 8. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Would not indefinite detention without charge
be excessive bail?
Yeah, it would be excessive bail because it's infinite.
It's infinite, which means that they didn't set a bail amount.
And it's cruel and unusual punishment.
It can very well be, absolutely.
You're being incarcerated for nothing.
Well, see, and the other thing is, too, Chuck, that we have to be clear about, when we said that, you know, indefinite detention violates the excessive bail requirement, the point is, when you read that phrase in the Eighth Amendment, it assumes that there is a requirement for there to be a bail set in order for you to retain your liberty until you're proven guilty.
Guilty, yeah.
And that is a key principle of American, has been a key principle, I should say, of American jurisprudence from the founding era forward, because what was King George doing? They were detaining the colonists and keeping them at, and then shipping them to England, and then not scheduling trials or anything else for a while.
Yeah, exactly, and that is why in the Declaration of Independence, the writers of that document, and by the way, Thomas Jefferson was the drafter; he was not the author. That document went through several revisions by a committee. And one of the things that they make a complaint about, and in my little talk that I do, and by the way, folks, videos of this are available at www.campamerican.com. That's www.campamerican.com. I give a little talk on the inseparability of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
I would strongly encourage our listeners to go out there and get that, because
yes,
it is a fantastic exercise, a walk through both the, what I would call, the theory and the practice, Chuck.
It's a $10 donation to Camp American, and believe me, it's a worthy cause. We teach constitutional principles to young people and adults, so if you want to be a camper or a volunteer and come see what we've got to teach, we've got some sample videos out there. But anyway,
yeah. Well, I want to go back.
Let's go to this point on the Declaration of Independence,
go right ahead. Okay,
because the drafters of the Declaration made specific reference to this idea of being dragged out of your jurisdiction to be tried for crimes, mm-hmm, in a foreign jurisdiction.
That's right.
And that's exactly what they were claiming was happening, and that's exactly what is forbidden in both Article 3 of the Constitution. And this came up in our Constitution class last week. This was one of our questions. We won't give you the question because it may pop up again.
We're not going to give the answer either.
And it was also, we actually had two people that found it, mm-hmm, because it's also in Article 6 of the Bill of Rights.
Yes,
the Sixth Amendment.
Sixth Amendment, which is where I want to go back to after we talk about the Declaration.
But that's where I'm going to, because I wanted to talk about Article 6, because it's a real important part of the NDA that the NDAA has wiped out here.
Yes, it has.
So you want to read it?
Well, we're going to go back to the Declaration first,
okay,
because the point that we're talking about here, and these were some of the complaints that the founders had about the British government, specifically the king, because their covenant was with the king, not with Parliament.
That's right.
The 18th of 27, you know, and everybody thinks, you know, taxation without representation. Well, that was number 17.
Right, that's right.
But number 18 says, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury. Well, I think indefinite detention kind of violates your benefits of trial by jury. Number 19, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses. This right here, bingo, Chuck, right there, right in the middle of it, saying, hey, this is what they're doing. You are just locked. You're doing all of this. You are not allowing us trials. You're taking us out of the colonies, and we have no recourse. Well, that's what the NDAA does right now for anybody who the president, and yes, it is up to the president of the United States. That's the reason why I think liberals are concerned, because they know that, you know, political winds change and Barack Obama won't always be their president. So they have to be concerned about, well, do we want to give too much power to any president to be able to do something like this?
If you recall, Barry, you and I were became friends very early on in the Bush administration.
Yeah, well, that wasn't the reason why we became friends.
No.
It may have been one of the causes.
We came together over the George Bush election. No, that didn't happen.
No.
But the Patriot Act was new at that point.
Yes.
And we discussed that very issue. The fact that basically you want to turn all this power over to the executive branch. Okay. Well, we trust the president. I'm like, okay, put Hillary Clinton in the office. Do you still trust? Well, and then we had a number of friends who, during the 2008 election, were basically anybody but Hillary. And I've asked several of those people since, you still like what you got besides Hillary? Do you think Hillary would have gotten away with the stuff that this guy has? No, probably not, is usually the answer. So that's exactly what you're seeing in California. You're seeing a fear of handing over the power to someone they fear in the other party.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly... Now, you and I take a look at it and say, I fear any party in power with this kind of authority.
Amen.
Now, I want to bring up something else that may be not be clear from the Declaration of Independence, but it really fits in this case. And that is the next complaint. And the one after the next one.
Right, okay.
The next one is for transporting us beyond the seas to be tried for pretended offenses. That's the one I was bringing up.
Right, that's number 19.
Right. Well, there's also, you brought up for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury.
That's objection 18, yes.
Yes. But here's the next one. For abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies. Okay, that seems a little obscure at this point. So let's unpack it a bit. For abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province.
Let me just unpack it with a name. Governor William Andros.
Yes. Okay, what they're talking about in that is abolishing the common law.
That's right.
And what we know is the common law. And if you don't think the common law is a thing in the United States, I would invite you to read Article 7, where it says, in suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. So common law is in there twice. I actually had someone who called himself a constitutional scholar tell me there was no common law in the Constitution.
Whoops.
Yeah, sorry guys, there it is. But what was happening was the common law had been abolished in the province of Quebec.
Quebec, exactly.
And the Parliament was attempting to expand Quebec's boundaries down into what are now the Northwest Territories.
Yes.
Those were held by charter by the state, or the colony at the time, of Virginia.
Yes, it was.
So what they were trying to do was expand this non-common law, this really a French law, down into areas of Virginia. Well, that did not sit well with the colonists because they saw what was coming. They wanted the common law protections, and one of the things being trial by jury that we just mentioned in Article 7. So They call it establishment of an arbitrary government and enlarging its boundaries so it's render at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into the colonies. What's that have to do with the NDAA? Well, the NDAA is attempting to abolish the common law and the constitutional protections that are meant by that establishment of the common law in the United States of America. So what does the Declaration of Independence have any effect on the way we think about our rights and liberties now? Folks, this is why Barry and I went to the Ohio legislature and fought so that the founding documents would have to be taught at the high school level, because believe it or not, until we passed got this law passed, I think, what was it, in the 2011? Was it 11 or 10?
10.
It was 2010. We joined together with groups like the Ohio Christian Alliance and got that that bill passed. And believe me, it was hard fought. How late were we in that committee room on the last night before it got out of committee?
I don't.
10 o'clock, 10:30 at night.
Oh, it was late.
11 o'clock, because we created such a stir that they had to go into executive session to deal with the things that we had told them.
Yes.
In that room. That's why we wanted this law passed, so these things had to be taught, because we have lost that part of our heritage. How many of you have read the Declaration of Independence and have understood that particular clause from that point of view? How many of you knew about the attempts to expand the boundaries of Quebec down into the colony of Virginia before the Declaration of Independence? It's a very important consideration, because it's in repeat mode right now. Except instead of being done from England, it's being done from Washington. This is why we fought the NDAA tooth and toenail here.
And we'll probably have to fight its implementation at the state level, just like assemblymen and senators did in California.
Now, here's the sad part. A very similar bill was introduced last session in the Ohio legislature.
Yes.
Where did it go? In the round file.
Round file, that's right.
It went in the round file. So we had our chance here to do the same thing. And in fact, this is one of the points of talking about this, folks. People get all in a fluster when people start talking about nullification. And what they think about, they go immediately to the nullification crisis of the 1830s and how horrible it was. Well, the nullification crisis really was a great idea, because what was happening, Barry? They were nullifying federal tariffs.
Right.
That were usurious. They were draconian tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
Huge percentages. And people don't understand what that means. Well, the South was an agrarian economy, which required the import of goods that they couldn't manufacture. That means that they were basically paying these gigantic tariffs to import this equipment that they couldn't get in the United States, and they couldn't manufacture themselves. So basically, they were being denuded of their treasure, paying these taxes, which then, did the taxes get used in the South? No.
No, of course not.
They did to an extent, but the taxes were mostly eaten up in the North with corporate welfare.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why the nullification crisis came about. Now, what a lot of people don't want to talk about, and let's talk about Dr. Tom Wood's book, Nullification, real quick.
Sure.
Because he points out other places where people would think, oh, nullification worked out pretty well.
Oh, yes.
One of those places was the Fugitive Slave Act.
Yes, that's right.
The states of Wisconsin, for sure, and I think Minnesota, basically had state courts that came in and said, that law is null and void in the state of Wisconsin. And the Wisconsin legislature, I believe, passed laws that said, you can't enforce that here. So these guys who were going around collecting these escaped slaves would bring them into court for extradition so they could take them home, and they'd say, that law is null and void here. You could not get a court order to take an escaped slave home in the state of Wisconsin, period. The federal law passed in the 1850s was nullified.
And Chuck, it's something that can be used today. You know, we have state legislators who wring their hands over the powerlessness that they have against the federal government. No, they don't. Well, first of all, they are less powerful than they were prior to the passage of the 17th Amendment, where the direct election of senators started happening and the state legislatures lost their check in the federal government.
That's right.
However, they're not without tools to deal with this issue. First of all, as Dr. Joel McDermott would say in his book Restoring America, which we use in our Institute on the Constitution classes,
and we sell in our bookstore,
they need to be disciplined not to take the cheese. Don't go after all the federal handouts. Don't go after all the federal grant programs. Don't say it's our money when somebody has to go into deeper debt spending in order to give you that money, Governor Kasich.
Yes,
because that's talking about Medicaid expansion. You know, that money is there, Charles. But in order to say, well, we're going to expand Medicaid because, well, that's our money. How can it be your money when we're already $16 trillion in debt and we got to go another $6 to $7 trillion in order to get you that money?
It'll only be your money when they raise the taxes to pay for the $6.3 trillion Medicaid expansion, if it is implemented nationally,
right,
will cost the U.S. Treasury.
Right, that's exactly what it would be. So, you know, they do have power.
Yes.
Stop taking the cheese. Then, secondly, now, we've heard everybody from Mark Levin to, I hate to say it, David Barton of Wall Builders say the same thing, which shows me that although they may be great as historical analysts, they have a real hard time with actually reading the Constitution clearly.
Yes.
Because they both say nullification's unconstitutional. No, it's not. If that's the case, then the 10th Amendment is null and void completely.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Now, we've been using Dr. McDermott's Restoring America One County at a Time, and he makes the point in there about George Marshall's rulings and how he basically said, yeah, the 10th Amendment says that, but it doesn't use the word expressly reserved. And let's read the 10th Amendment.
Sure.
The 10th Amendment is the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now, what George Marshall's ruling said, and I can't remember the case, we can dig that up.
Well, it was McCulloch versus Maryland, wasn't it?
No, that's the...
Was it the Ogden case?
Yeah, it was the Ogden case, okay. I'm pretty sure. What he said was, had they really meant to make it not alterable by the courts. Now, get that, by the courts, not by
right.
Congress,
not by
the
Congress.
Courts. It should have read, the powers not expressly delegated to the United States by the Constitution. So, because the framers left out the word expressly, which, by the way, was in the Articles of Confederation, then somehow that means nullification is illegal, even though the power is delegated to the states or to the people, respectively. Well, actually, it's not delegated to them. It's retained by them. There is a... Okay, let's talk about the difference between that in that language. Words mean things.
Yes, they do.
That means it's our right in the first place. If a power is delegated to you, that means it belongs to... delegated by you. It belongs to you, and you give it to someone else. You don't actually give it to them. You loan it to them. Therefore, nullification is the revocation of that loan. Because it's being abused. We're taking it back because you are not handling it properly. That's what those words mean.
Yes, it is.
Now, let's talk about a case where nullification recently has been used successfully. And our friend Tom DeWeese from the American Policy Center points this out as well. And we give kudos to Tom because he's talking about using nullification at the local level, which is also a place. You don't have to just do it at the state level. He's talking about doing it at the local level with Agenda 21.
That's right.
So that's a case where you need to be diligent and go to your city council meetings and engage in nullification. Okay, so where has it been used successfully recently? Well, we've been talking about the NDAA and the Patriot Act. let's talk about Real ID.
Absolutely.
Because Real ID is a nullification success story.
Well, a partial success story.
Yes, partial. It was successful here temporarily in Ohio. What Real ID was a program to require a unified driver's license as a personal ID card, so that basically you could go anywhere in the country and somebody on the street could stop you and say, "Your papers, please." It would have had embedded in it all kinds of personal information in a chip. You would have had facial recognition,
biometric data,
all kinds of stuff in it. And the Western states took one look at it and said, not here. I think Colorado passed it, Wyoming, Idaho, several Western states. I've named three. Ohio even passed a non-real ID law and basically said, no, we're not going to do that. Well, unfortunately, in Ohio, it's been backdoored back in.
Yes.
So we have Real ID without having it called Real ID.
Right. The state went and accepted some federal grants in order to do it, and they agreed to basically put all the provisions of what the Real ID Act would have done in order to get the grant money. So the BMV... And, of course, how they do that is they go to the thing called the controlling board, Charles.
Yes.
They get the grant, and then they go to the controlling board and ask them for money, and it bypasses the legislature, per se, although the controlling board is made up of representatives from both the House and the Senate of both parties. There are members of the legislature on the controlling board who authorize where the spending goes, but the full legislature doesn't pass the provisions.
Folks, this is one of the ways that... you basically lose your liberty without knowing. You think your representative is representing you, when in fact he may very, very often be stabbing you in the back. Because how many of you out there ever actually heard of the controlling board?
I'm sure that unless they're like me and I like do this for a living, very few people have ever heard
of it. I'm only barely familiar with it. I've heard of it. I've known some of the shadowy things they've done. And, you know, you need to keep an eye on groups like the controlling board, because
they meet publicly. You can go and sit. It's usually over in the Senate finance hearing room, and there's a balcony, and you can go up and sit, and you can listen to all the hot air. And, you know, if it's a cold day, go up in the balcony because you get lots of hot air.
I was going to say, take a fan and make sure you caffeine up.
Yes.
Because, folks, let me tell you, that's one of the problems that you run into with these big government boards, committees. Very often it's procedural drivel. I mean, you're sitting there waiting for them to get through this and that and another thing to get to the thing you're looking for. And a lot of people just give up and they don't want to go anymore. Let me tell you, that's something that unfortunately you have to do. You really do have to do it. Believe me, I've done it. I got told about a hearing the other day, and I'm going through some business issues, so I just flat out couldn't go because I couldn't take the emotional churning that goes on in those things. Don't let that discourage you, because it's something you gotta do. And if you don't, you'll lose your liberty.
Very much could. It's our government only works, Chuck, because the people are involved in it. If you let government go without being involved, whether you tell them, you know, what you need or what you don't want to see happen, and you expect them to act altruistically on your part, well, you're hoping for something that never was and never will be, because that's not how government acts. We call it the pleasure and pain principle. You know, if they're getting lots of pleasure, they're going to go the direction of the pleasure. If they're getting lots of pain, they're going to go away from the direction that's causing them the pain. Well, guess what? That's where you come in. Either you can reward them, you know, with accolades and well wishes and prayers for doing a good job, for doing the right thing, or you can give them pain for not doing the right thing. You know, call their phones and, you know, stand up, protest. I mean, just down at the State House this week, there was this, you know, quote-unquote massive, I laugh, it's sort of like the Million Man March massacre.
Yeah, yeah.
Protest of Democrat and women protesting against all the pro-life provisions that the budget it was passed in the budget. Well, it's a little too late for that, I think, because those provisions are passed. But what they're trying to do, Chuck, is they're trying to gin up a PR campaign so that when they file suit in a federal court, that they're trying to capture the emotional argument, because they're probably going to lose on legal arguments.
Sure. And that goes on a lot. Where we were going with this,
yes,
was the fact that what California is beginning to recognize and what Ohio has ignored is that the Constitution itself is being violated. Now, Barry and I, it's no secret that we are opponents of an Article 5 convention. And I will...
I hope it's no secret.
If it's a secret, you're really not paying very close attention.
That's right.
But the fact is that I will argue all day long that we do not have a Constitution problem. What we have is a representation problem.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that people are arguing for is term limits, term limits, term limits. Well, term limits can be a disaster, because what happens is the people who are really principled get broomed out by the parties. The real problem is that we need to stop thinking in terms of a two-party system. The United States was not... I keep hearing the United States was designed to be a two-party system. No, it is not. In fact, it was designed to be a no-party system.
Exactly.
One of the things that Washington and Hamilton and Jefferson talked about was the idea of faction. Faction is political parties. And the fact is that political parties have seized control of the apparatus. So what happens? It becomes a spitting match over some things that very often are peripheral or secondary or even tertiary in order to save political face and win votes. Well, we need, you know, people are talking about third parties. Well, there are all kinds of third parties out there, but we need to stop thinking in terms of the big two. And get people to start thinking in terms of political principle.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case, Chuck, because if we continue to do the same thing we've always done in the same way we always do it, and we expect a different result, well, I think that was the historic definition of insanity.
Well, absolutely. And what really is going on here, as I mentioned earlier on, is that place where the two roads, the two really dichotomous ways of looking at government, sort of come together. Because it shows that even the left recognizes the idea that there have to be limits to government.
Amen.
They may not agree to what those limits are, but they agree that there have to be limits.
That somehow there has to be boundaries. Because without boundaries, it's tyranny.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what they're attempting to negate in their state. Now, I understand the thing about taking the penalty phase out, because you know what that means. What they're worried about is that somebody's going to step in and arrest the federal judge and refuse to release him on the court order of another federal judge, because you know that would happen. One of the things that the anti-federalists were very clear about in the anti-federalist papers was you cannot make the federal government the final arbiter of its own power. When you do that, you're going to get tyranny as an endpoint. And that's exactly what AB 351 is saying without saying it. We're attempting to make sure that the federal government is not the final arbiter of its own power. And that's what's wrong with the idea that the Supreme Court's the final judge. The Supreme Court is not the final judge. Actually, that power is in the hands of the legislatures and the state government.
Absolutely.
So, I personally look to this as a positive sign. It's not a sign that the ship of state has been righted by any stretch of the imagination. She's still down by the bow and sinking fast.
Still listing heavily,
but
yes.
Somebody's at least trying to shove a mattress in the hole.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Chuck, you know, again, this can be a touchstone. This can be a rallying point, even if it comes from the liberal left California. The key is, we've got somebody standing up and saying, wait a minute, we've got to strike a balance here. And that balance is a constitutional liberty.
Yeah. And with that, I have to step up and say we're out of time.
Yes.
Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.